He allowed the states to decide something that the people kept telling him that they wanted, for the state governments to decide how to control women's bodies?
I mean, you know, again, you have this situation where Donald Trump is claiming credit for overturning Roe v. Wade, but then saying he's going to make IVF free, and then saying maybe he's going to vote in favor of the abortion rights ballot initiative in Florida, but then maybe he's not, but then maybe he will again. I mean, Trump is a moving target. But look, we have to look at his record here. What did this man do? He overturned 50 years of precedent, right? He put the Supreme Court justices on the court to overturn Roe v. Wade. People are not going to forget that. I mean, to quote the great Taylor Swift, who, of course, endorsed Kamala Harris and Tim Walz on Tuesday. In plain sight, you hid, but you are what you did. Okay? I don't think we're going to forget what Donald Trump did when it comes to abortion rights.
Well, Amy Littlefield, we want to thank you very much for being with us. And when Taylor Swift issued that endorsement last night, she signed it Childless Cat Lady with a photo of her cradling one of her cats. Amy Littlefield, abortion access correspondent at The Nation. I want to thank all the folks who joined us today, including Ralph Nader and Joe Stiglitz. And you can see our continued debate that they will have after the show at democracynow.org, and Carol Anderson, as well as Jean Guerrero. This is Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Sharifa Dokadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresaina, Tammy Warren, Afterina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Development Committee meeting will be held on Monday, September 30th at 5:30 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify a meeting is being held.
The leaves are falling, the birds are chirping, and KBOO's Fall Membership Drive is back. If you enjoy alternative radio that pushes the status quo, then support KBOO by becoming a member today. Donate online at kboo.fm/give between now and September 21st and support independent airwaves.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Support for the KBOO Evening News comes from Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at Southeast 8th and Burnside in Portland. Featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this special membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council votes to adopt the new police oversight system.
The federal court case against the Kroger-Albertsons merger stretches into another week.
And Umatilla County explores building nuclear energy infrastructure.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 11th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. Portland City Council votes to adopt sweeping code language establishing a new police oversight system for the city. The vote comes a week after an emergency ordinance on the same language failed to pass. It came nearly 2 weeks after Judge Michael Simon approved amendments to the settlement agreement that Portland has with the U.S. Department of Justice. That agreement is over a decade old. Federal officials had to intervene after seeing Portland police had a pattern of using excessive force on residents experiencing mental illness. The amendments approved by the judge meant that the new police oversight system that 86% of voters approved in 2020 can now go forward. Judge Simon also ruled that the committee shouldn't be implemented until the new city council takes office in 2025. That decision came after multiple community members testified that the code language put forward by the city was actually a real step back from what the All-Volunteer Police Accountability Commission proposed. The delay upset the city council, particularly Mayor Ted Wheeler and Commissioners Gonzalez and Ryan. Under the settlement agreement with the Justice Department, the city had to pass this measure before September 19th to start a one-year implementation timeline. The code language was reintroduced this week and voted on as a normal ordinance. Commissioner Rene Gonzalez was on the sole no vote. In his comments, he lamented the DOJ settlement and the oversight board's existence. Here is some of what he said today.
I had planned to support this code language on a federal judge's decision to placate police abolitionists and abolitionist adjacent segments in our community and undermine a democratically elected body has changed my mind. It has been a decade since the start of federal intervention in Portland police interactions with those suffering from mental illness on our streets. A number of mayors and police chiefs have come and gone, but federal intervention continues. In that decade, we have seen marked decreases in public safety, in our ability to retain police officers in the city of Portland, despite some recent improvements. Despite the significant downsides of a decade-long and material DOJ and judicial intervention, it's hard to find any evidence that things have improved for those suffering mental illness on our streets. If we were to go back in time, federal intervention in the state's failure to treat mental illness may have led to more positive outcomes. We have a federal judge in this case that appears to be enamored with the protester class. He should consider this a protest vote. I vote no.
That was Commissioner Rene Gonzalez voting no on adopting a police oversight board. It's worth noting that while Gonzalez asserts that Portland has experienced a, quote, marked decrease in public safety, extensive reporting by street routes indicates that that idea is not supported by the data. In fact, available PPP data do not show that Portland is in the midst of a crime wave, as Gonzalez indicated. The Portland police budget is the highest it's ever been, at $295 million. Arrests have plummeted over the last 4 years, and the emergency call volume was only 6% higher in the first 6 months of 2023 versus 2019. Now that the code language has passed, the new city council will appoint a committee to select the police oversight board in the new year.
The federal trial against grocery giant Kroger's proposed merger with Albertsons will be extended into next week. It's taking place in Oregon, where the state attorney general has sued to block the merger, along with seven other states and the Federal Trade Commission. The trial was supposed to end this Friday, but now that's been pushed out to next Friday. That could overlap with the other legal challenges against the merger. At the core of these legal actions is the creation of a grocery monopoly in areas where Kroger and Safeway, which is owned by Albertsons, are the only stores in town. That would likely be bad for shoppers. They can't compare prices and save money if there's only one option. Kroger says buying up Albertsons will actually allow them to cut prices, but there's nothing in the merger that requires them to do that. Market forces indicate the opposite is more likely to happen. Buying out Albertsons may not just be about the profit at the checkout stand for Kroger. The Oregonian reports that the data that Kroger collects on their customers' shopping habits are extremely lucrative. Merging with Albertsons means more data they can, quote, leverage. That portion of Kroger's business generated $1.3 billion in profit last year, over a third of the company's overall profit. If they do merge, that would increase Kroger's data access to 85 million households across 49 states. A Kroger executive testified that the company doesn't sell customer data to brands, but it does sell its own advertising services to the brands. They say it's a critical part of competing with Walmart, Amazon, and Costco. The trial against the merger is now scheduled to end next Friday.
The Umatilla County Board of Commissioners would like to build one or more nuclear reactors. They recently approved a $30,000 contract with Portland law firm Tonkintort to help the county draft legislation that would allow it to site small modular nuclear reactors, or SMRs, in the county. Commissioner Dan Duran said, quote, "We think that it's worth the effort and time to see if we can't find an alternative to what's already on the horizon, and see if we can't expand our zero carbon footprint and still take care of industry that's knocking on our door," end quote. A major obstacle to their plan is ballot measure 7. It was passed in 1980 after the partial meltdown at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. The measure prevents Oregon from creating any nuclear power plants until the federal government approves a nuclear waste depository, which has not happened. Last year, there was a bill in the Oregon House that would have created a voter referendum to reverse Measure 7. It received a couple of hearings but never made it out of its committee. There are currently no nuclear power plants in Oregon. Last November, Portland company NuScale Power, which has an SMR design approved by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, scrapped an 8-year project to build a reactor in Idaho.
Missouri voters will have an opportunity to restore abortion rights in the state. Yesterday, the Missouri Supreme Court restored Amendment 3, also known as the Right to Reproductive Freedom Initiative, to the November 5th ballot. The measure would enshrine abortion rights in the Missouri state constitution. Cole County Judge Christopher Limbaugh had previously removed the measure from the ballot. He said that the campaign did not do enough to inform voters that the measure would undo the state's abortion ban when collecting 380,000 signatures in support of the measure. Missouri currently has one of the country's harshest abortion bans. The procedure is prohibited in almost all circumstances, quote, except in cases of medical emergency, end quote. ACLU of Missouri appealed Judge Limbaugh's decision, and the Missouri Supreme Court promptly reversed it. Tori Schaefer, director of policy and campaigns for ACLU Missouri, said, quote, "Today's ruling ensures that Amendment 3 will appear on the November ballot, giving voters, not politicians, the power to decide on this critical issue," end quote. Missouri joins 7 other states, including Florida, Maryland, and Montana, which will have measures on the November ballot protecting the right to abortion. Every abortion rights ballot measure since the overturn of Roe v. Wade in 2022 has passed.
Trump and Harris meet in their first presidential debate. Republicans risk a government shutdown over false claims of non-citizen voting. And the Justice Department issues guidelines for voter roll maintenance as right-wing challenges surge. With those stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We cannot afford to have a president of the United States who attempts, as he did in the past, to upend the will of the voters in a free and fair election.
In their first debate, Vice President Kamala Harris sparred with former President Donald Trump over his claim the 2020 election was stolen. Trump rejected responsibility for January 6th. He cited his assassination attempt before accusing Democrats, including then-Speaker Nancy Pelosi, of being at fault during the riot.
I probably took a bullet to the head because of the things that they say about me. They talk about democracy. I'm a threat to democracy. They're the threat to democracy.
For her part, Harris notably tried to get past the personal insults often made by her opponent, returning several times to details of her economic plans. On abortion, Trump refused to confirm a promise that he would veto a national ban. Harris responded with stories about women who have suffered because they couldn't get reproductive health care. The former president also repeated false claims that Democrats are allowing illegal immigrants into the country to tip the election.
Our elections are bad, and a lot of these illegal immigrants coming in, they're trying to get them to vote.
On Capitol Hill, Trump has instructed House Republicans to let government funding lapse if language requiring proof of citizenship for voter registration is not in the stopgap spending plan. House Speaker Mike Johnson says he wants it included when they vote this week.
If you have a few thousand illegals participating in an election in the wrong place, you can change the makeup of Congress and you can affect the presidential election.
He may not have the votes. Several House Republicans have publicly announced their opposition to any continuing resolution. Funding runs out on the 30th. It's already illegal for non-citizens to vote in federal elections, and it almost never happens. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is defending his move to send special election police to question residents who signed an abortion rights amendment petition. He says they're investigating fraud and not intimidating his political opponents. But Democratic State Representative Anna Escomney calls it corrosive for democracy.
It's just shameful behavior. It's an abuse of power. It's corruption. And I really do hope Floridians see through it.
The Department of Justice has issued new guidance on how states can clean voter registration rolls. This follows a surge of lawsuits, mostly from right-wing groups, seeking access to the data and challenging procedures. Houston Democratic City Council member Abby Kamen says Texas Republicans are crowing over the removal of 1 million registrations over the past 3 years, which will suppress legitimate votes.
It's the fear-mongering and the sowing of confusion that is dissuading and concerning voters.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $30,000 by September 21st. And we'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. In this episode, Christopher Hall with the Water League talks modernizing Oregon's water code. At 6, it's Big Picture Science Radio. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 54 degrees. Tomorrow, those clouds continue with a daytime high of 71 degrees. Today in history, in 1792, the Hope Diamond is stolen, along with other French crown jewels, when 6 men broke into the house where they were stored. The quote of the day is from English novelist D.H. Lawrence, who wrote in the poem Self-Pity, quote, "I never saw a wild thing sorry for itself. A small bird will drop frozen dead from a bow without ever having felt sorry for itself."
In the aftermath of the first presidential debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, advocates hope the debate leads to turnout growth for Native voters. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump took to the stage Tuesday night for their first presidential debate. During the 90-minute debate, the candidates did not directly mention tribes, but covered a number of issues impacting Indian country, from healthcare to climate change to reproductive rights. While the candidates talked about where they stand on the issues, Native vote advocates and Native organizations are working on voter and election education, engagement, and outreach. New findings that look at Native Americans participating in elections are mixed. But North Dakota outreach leaders say they're coming off a strong summer of civic engagement. The Native American Rights Fund last month reported national growth trends among tribal populations for voter turnout, including a 14 percentage point increase between 2018 and 2020. But because of longstanding barriers, there's still a significant gap compared with non-Hispanic white voters. In responding to those concerns, Erica Red Tomahawk with North Dakota Native Vote says her team connected with people at powwows across reservations in North Dakota.
There was a lot of meaningful conversations about the importance of voting, with even some individuals expressing that they were going to run for official positions themselves. So it was clear that there was a strong desire to participate actively within civic processes.
Red Tomahawk says staff did chat with some individuals who felt a disconnect with the voting process. She says for groups like hers, those conversations are vital because the goal is to assist tribal voters in understanding that their voice matters.
Indian country in North Dakota is huge. You know, we have relatives everywhere, and being able for them to vote and share their voice as a collective, to have more representation, it's very important.
Her group engaged with more than 200 prospective voters at summer events who received information on polling locations and voter ID requirements. She's optimistic that the energy from these events will result in stronger voter turnout this fall. A Northern California tribe is celebrating its receipt of nearly 500 acres of coastal ranch land north of San Francisco. As Jacob Resnick reports, the Federated Indians of Grayton Rancheria received the property from a conservation group seeking to return ancestral lands to tribal entities.
The Grayton Rancheria received the 466-acre ranch from the Western Rivers Conservancy, which bought the Marin County property last year. The mile and a half of Pacific coastline was a gift from the Conservancy, which has worked with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to engineer returning the land to Coast Miwok and Southern Pomo tribal members for conservation and stewardship. Grayton Rancheria Chairman Greg Saris called the acquisition a remarkable opportunity to take responsibility for the ranch, which is just north of Dillon Beach, a coastal community with a popular private campground.
It's a great example of what can happen when tribes work with other organizations so that the land once again becomes under the stewardship of the people who've known it from time immemorial.
Grayton Rancheria operates the San Francisco Bay Area's largest casino and resort in nearby Sonoma County, but the tribe says the ranch includes sacred sites, which will be set aside for long-term conservation and protection. State wildlife officials have identified the area as among the most significant habitat areas in California. I'm Jacob Resnick in Sonoma County, California.
Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin and Navajo Nation Council Speaker Crystalyn Curley were among those to attend the U.S. Department of the Interior Secretary's Tribal Advisory Committee meeting this week, hosted by Secretary Deb Haaland in Washington, D.C. The two-day meeting with federal agencies brought together tribal representatives from the 12 Bureau of Indian Affairs regions. Among issues Navajo leaders discussed, water rights, improving infrastructure, and efforts to stop the transportation of uranium ore through Navajo land. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Both former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris presented some misleading and at times outright false claims during their first debate. Trump stated, quote, "I created one of the greatest economies in the history of our country. They destroyed the economy," end quote. In reality, the economy grew much faster under Presidents Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan than it did under Trump. And contrary to destroying the economy, in Biden's first 43 months in office, the U.S. added about 16 million jobs. On a deeper level, Felix Koenig, a professor of economics at Carnegie Mellon University, says it is, quote, "very difficult," end quote, to attribute changes in the labor market and economy to one presidential administrator versus another. Former President Trump falsely accused vice presidential pick Tim Walz of condoning abortions in the ninth month and executions after birth. Moderator David Muir intervened, saying that no state has a law that permits killing a baby postpartum. Tim Walz has never condoned infanticide. Trump falsely claimed evidence shows he won the presidential election in 2020. He stated, quote, "there's so much proof. All you have to do is look at it," end quote. Authorities who have reviewed the election, including Trump's own attorney general, have concluded the election was fair. Biden won the Electoral College with 306 votes to Trump's 232, and the popular vote by more than 7 million ballots. Recounts in key states confirmed Biden's victory, and lawsuits challenging the results were unsuccessful. Harris discussed the Conservative Project 2025 administrative blueprint, stating Trump intends on implementing it if he were reelected again. Project 2025 was indeed written by former Trump aides and allies, but Trump has not explicitly said he would put it into practice.
Mental health experts have released a checklist for parents of students headed back to school. Research shows kids who need services are often going without. Substance abuse and mental health experts say half of students who are clinically depressed are not getting the mental health care they need. Caitlin Hochul with the mental health advocacy group Inseparable says that's why it is so important those services are available to students as they return to school.
They help improve access to care and are really one of the most effective tools we have to help improve children's mental health well-being because we are reaching kids where they spend most of their time, and that is in schools.
The U.S. Department of Education says young people who get school-based services are six times more likely to complete treatment than those who get their services in community settings. A program at Montana State University has shown success in reducing the teen suicide rate by increasing mental health literacy among young students. Hochul says research shows increasing mental health literacy decreases symptoms of depression and notes there are several steps to achieving that goal.
One is making sure that kids understand what brain health is, what mental health is, similar to physical health education. And then there's also training up staff and teachers, too. So they're understanding warning signs and can help with suicide prevention and substance use disorder prevention.
Hochul says regular mental health check-ins with kids, even if they are just informal, can help identify students who may need support.
Pediatricians are cutting back on their orders of COVID shots as demand for the perishable vaccine wanes. Suzanne Potter has more in California.
Pediatricians are ordering their COVID vaccines now for the winter season, but waning interest from families means many doctors are struggling to predict how much to stock, according to reporting from KFF Health News. Some medical practices are only ordering about 5% of what they normally order for flu shots. Orange County pediatrician Dr. Eric Ball says the COVID vaccine has been very effective in protecting kids and adults from severe disease.
And unfortunately, we are still seeing some children who are getting quite ill. We are still hospitalizing children with COVID, particularly the youngest children. And I'm still seeing some children who are having symptoms of long COVID. And there's a lot of evidence that vaccination is probably the best way to prevent any of that from happening.
The vaccine has to be refrigerated and must be discarded after 30 days, a significant loss for the medical practice. Vaccine manufacturers' return policy varies, but some will only take back 30% of unused vaccine for adults and kids over age 12. Children under age 3 must get COVID shots in a doctor's office and cannot be vaccinated at a pharmacy. So if doctors don't order enough vaccine doses this year, families with infants and toddlers may have a hard time finding the shot. Ball says misinformation has led many parents to hold off on getting kids their updated COVID shots.
The first year, we had a huge uptake, and we were seeing the majority of our patients get their children COVID vaccines, especially the older kids. And each year, the rate seems to be lower and lower. California records show that last year, for most age groups for children, the rate was under 10%, and for many, it was under 5%.
Paul says he hopes manufacturers will loosen their return policies and develop new COVID vaccines with a longer shelf life. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that anyone 6 months of age or older get the updated COVID vaccination. This story was produced with original reporting by Jackie Fortier for KFF Health News. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Vice presidential candidate and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz was a high school teacher for much of his career. Mike Mowen spoke to some of his former colleagues for insights into the candidate.
The start of a new school year in Minnesota has a new twist, intense focus from national media and voters across the U.S. With Governor Tim Walz running for vice president, many are trying to measure his impact from the classroom to policy decisions. On the campaign trail, Governor Walz has talked about his career as a public school teacher. On the governing side, his push to help adopt free school meals for all students has drawn attention. Some of his former colleagues from Mankato West High School are speaking out, including retired social studies teacher Bob Eyrig. He says Walz exceeded their expectations when they hired him.
He's just an outstanding role model for any future teacher. There's a lot of hope and inspiration with Tim Walz.
Eyrig suggests that could help make the profession appealing to younger generations amid teacher shortages. In politics, Walz maintains strong support from unions, including the American Federation of Teachers, for actions like taking a hard stance against private school vouchers. But his opponents argue he kept schools closed for too long during the pandemic, subsequently hurting student test scores. But Walz supporters say he took proper steps to keep everyone safe and that his administration is committed to reducing learning gaps. Current Mankato West teacher Aaron Miller says student performance is a complex issue along with education funding. Under Walz, public schools have received a big boost, but many districts still have tight budgets. Miller says it could be a lot worse.
That money that was thrown out really just kind of helped us kind of catch up a little bit. Public school funding is a hornet's nest of people demanding certain things, and there are a lot of things to consider when you're going into it. Property taxes.
Miller feels the perception of public schools is too steep in culture war issues often pushed by conservative groups. While he doesn't agree with every policy move Walz has made, Miller says renewed focus on the mission aligned with being a teacher should stay in the limelight much longer.
We need our administrations, we need our State Department of Education to do some things to help reinstill that sense of support and respect.
This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael heard on KBOO yesterday that wealth creates poverty.
At the U.S. Open Tennis Tournament, you could buy a box of six chicken nuggets with some caviar and creme fraiche for $100. The Roman Empire's got nothing on us. New two-bedroom apartments in southeast Portland, miles from downtown, start at $3,000 a month. A poll of over 500 KBOO listeners showed top concerns 2 through 4 as cost of living, homelessness, and affordable housing. Every week, the Oregonian runs a list of the 10 most expensive homes sold in Portland, rarely any less than a million. Also articles about whether mega company Live Nation or partly local group will build a close-in 4,000-seat arena for concerts that probably won't have any tickets less than 150. And KBOO listeners' number one concern, the climate crisis. As the wealthy gobble multiple shares of electricity and water, then go to the oh-so-beautiful Portland airport to fly to tourist destinations where the locals are protesting being priced out of their homes and towns. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 11th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Hannah Francis, myself, Josh Salem, and Dan Raphael. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Suzanne Potter, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, and Mike Moen. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming,